and welcome to the Flower Friends podcast. This is Sarah Nayani coming at you from Seattle, Washington, where I grow loads of flowers in my small city yard and create floral arrangements that bring the outside in with local seasonal ingredients. On the pod, I share my experience switching careers and starting my small flower business, Grow Girl Seattle, and I interview inspiring guests about flower growing and floral design. I hope you'll come along with me as a flower friend to learn and grow together. Today's episode is the third in a three-part series about signature flowers and seed starting. In parts one and two, I shared a process I used this year to try to focus my flower growing efforts. Part one covers the general process, and I try to keep it general in case you want to try the exercise for yourself without me inserting my preferences into your brainstorm. Part two covers my personal favorite flowers and foliage. I shared everything from my brainstorm, all of the plant names, and I kind of discussed how I brainstormed it and then how I narrowed down that bigger list into signature flowers and a list of what I'll be growing this year. On today's episode, which is part three, I'm going to share how I start seeds here at my house, both for indoor and outdoor sowing. So I'll go through my timing, what my setup is like, kind of cover the tools and some of the supplies that I like to use, how I get my seeds started, and I'll share a few tips and tricks that I've picked up along the way. But before we get into seed starting, I wanted to give you some updates because I have some really exciting things coming up. So this episode that you're listening to right now is the last episode of season three, and I've been calling it the Sarah Session, season three. It's just been me solo discussing some like winter, early spring topics that have really been on my mind during this time related to mindset and to planning. But I'm proud of myself. I got pretty fancy this February and March because I've been working on two podcast seasons at once. So you might have noticed I've been a little bit bad at getting the season three episodes out when I wanted to. A lot of that is just because I've been busy interviewing guests for season four at the same time that I've been trying to get these season three episodes out. But I am so excited to share season four with you, where I interview amazing guests, and I will release the first episode of season four shortly. So yeah, in season four, we'll be back to having guests on the podcast, but I still might throw in a few Sarah sessions here and there when certain topics strike me, because it's just good to kind of keep fresh with what's going on this time of year, at least for me. I hope it is for you guys too. So speaking of topics that strike me, my next update for you is that season four is going to include some interviews and some info on peat alternatives. Ever since I first got really into gardening, I loved watching some UK gardening shows. Like, two of my favorites are Big Dream, Small Spaces, and Gardener's World. And as I've been watching those, of course, obviously, I fell in love with Monty Don, who, by the way, is the patron saint of this podcast. But ever since I started watching those, I've been hearing a lot from UK gardeners about concerns with using soil that contains peat, and I've wanted to learn more about how I could reduce peat in my garden. Just for anyone that doesn't know, peat is an exhaustible resource and it grows in bogs, which are a really important type of wetland for many reasons, ecologically, environmentally, but they store carbon. And so when we extract peat, we're not only impacting that important wetland, but we're also releasing carbon into the atmosphere, and that contributes to climate change. So the UK has been working on reducing peat usage for a long time now, keeping peat in the bogs. In the UK, they say, bogs, not bags, meaning like keep the peat in the bogs, don't put it in bags for garden use. But for a long time, the UK has been working on reducing peat at a governmental level, and they have different targets for when they're going to reduce and stop using peat over there. And then researchers all over the world have been working on peat-free alternatives for a while now. And there's a lot of growers here in the US and around the world that have been experimenting with and successfully reducing their peat usage. But I find, at least on a home garden scale, this conversation, and even as someone who's been in the flower world for a few years now, I don't hear a ton about peat here in the US. And maybe I'm just in the wrong rooms or the wrong conversations, but I definitely don't know as much as I would like to. And I find that it's a little bit difficult to get good information and find good products over here. So I just thought it would be useful to go into it a little bit on the podcast. And it can be difficult and expensive to change a system that you've had set up for a long time. It's not only hard sometimes to find alternatives here, but also to experiment with those alternatives, and just because it may require changes to programs that you've had dialed in for a long time. So just for example, if you've always started seeds with soil that includes peat, and you start either including a peat-free material into your mix, so you're reducing your peat usage, or you completely change your seed starting material over to peat-free, there might be differences in cost, in the quantity that you need, in watering requirements, moisture levels, things like that, that you kind of have to get worked out and test it so that you don't kill off your favorite seeds. So here at my house, I've been trying to limit peat outside in my garden beds by ordering bulk veggie mix and compost from a local company. And they use local ingredients to make many of their mixes. And I believe it's very low on peat. I actually reached out to them to find out more about peat usage in their soil, just because I'm curious. That's what I used in all my beds a few years ago. And I'm curious how much of that approximately includes peat or doesn't. But I think it's a pretty low peat content. This year, I really wanted to reduce peat usage in my seed starting setup as well. So back in January, I was doing some reading. I sat down to read some research about peat-free soil alternatives, and I actually ordered some new products to try. They're new to me. I think some of them have existed for a while, but they're new to me, peat-free products to try. And one of those is pit moss. That's just an example. I have a couple that I'm trying in my seed starting setup. I also found and contacted some substrate soil scientists, and I invited them onto the podcast to discuss their research on peat-free alternatives. And yeah, I just can't wait to share those episodes with you and kind of share what I've been learning. When I posted about this a few weeks ago, I actually got the biggest response that I've ever had on social media. So it seems to me like you guys really want to hear more about peat-free, and I'm glad I'm on the right track. I'm going to, you know, try to keep talking to people about this. And yeah, I'm hearing a lot of people responding that are like myself, who want to do what we can to reduce peat, but we're not exactly sure where to learn more and what's available. So I had another idea I'll try to sneak into season 4 or get onto a future season. I was thinking it would be great to interview reps from some different companies who make peat alternatives. This is not to like promote a single product, but just to ask questions and learn about different options, especially because here in the US, we don't seem to be as far along as the UK. This is just in my brain as a small flower grower, so there's probably a lot that I'm missing, but it doesn't seem like we're as far along as the UK in terms of like both general awareness about peat and then availability of peat-free products. Back in my career in fisheries, we would often interview panels of industry providers for pretty much anything we were searching for. So like if we were looking for new fishing cameras or gear research, net research, electronic monitoring, things like that, we would bring in a panel of industry providers and do some interviews to kind of learn more about those products. And so I thought it would be cool to do a similar industry panel interview and talk to several providers of peat-free alternative products and just ask them some of the questions that I'm curious about and share those on the podcast. I'm personally really interested in the intersection of a lot of these topics. So like science, industry, how things that are scientific get moved into industry and how scientists and industry members work together. I love government policy. I like learning about home consumption and kind of like how things are used in a real world way. Things like quality, sustainability, and then the environment. And so all of those topics to me kind of intersect really naturally. And that's what I used to work on in fisheries. So it turns out I'm very similarly enthusiastic about that intersection of topics in the flower world. And peat seems to be one area where those things kind of all meet. Okay, and another thing that I am so excited to tell you is that I started a hotline for the podcast. It's a Flower Friends hotline because I really want this podcast to be more interactive, and I've been thinking about different ways to do that, and I just would love to hear people's voice. And so I set up this hotline, and you guys will love this. The number is 7313-FLOWER. So it's actually a Tennessee number, but I just needed to have the word flower in it. I just felt like that was the way to go. So if you want to call in, it's 7313-FLOWER or 731-335-6937. So you can call in and leave a voicemail. I promise I'm not going to like pick up the phone if you call in. It's just that to take voicemails only, and it's just for the podcast. So it doesn't ring on my phone. I'm not going to pick up if you call in. It's just meant for you to call in and leave a voicemail recording. And if you do that, if you call in and leave a voicemail, I might play it on the podcast. So since peat free was such a hot topic when I did that Instagram post, I thought it would be cool if you wanted to call me and share your thoughts, your experience, different experiments you might be doing with peat alternatives or recipes that you love. And I'd love to hear kind of just what you're thinking about peat. And I'll try to pop some of your voicemails into season 4 as I'm weaving peat-free topics through the season. Or if you just have any fun stories you want to share, it doesn't have to be about peat. Anything you want to ask, anything flower related, I would love to hear from you. I'm just going to be so excited when I get my first voicemail, so please call in. It's one more time, 7313-FLOWER or 731-335-6937. Okay, let's get into seed starting. I love seed starting, especially in the winter. I find it's really nice to have like extra light and warmth inside from the lights and from the seed starting sand. And I love looking at like the new green shoots that are popping up out of the soil. It just brings some like hope into a very dark time in the winter. And I also love popping by the seed trays. I love looking at least a few times a day. I like to see when things germinate. I like to run my hands over like older seedlings. I feel like you have to talk to your flowers and you have to touch them. I just feel like that helps them grow. And I love experimenting with some different conditions in the seed starting setup just to see how that affects seed growth or not. I am by no means an expert in seed starting, but this is my 4th year where I've started hundreds of seeds for my garden inside my house. And I find seed starting to be really satisfying, and it's a really cost-effective way to grow flowers. One little packet of seeds can turn into buckets of stems, especially for flowers like poppies and zinnias. They can give you like 15 or 20 stems per plant. Or on perennial flowers like echinacea, they'll flower over several seasons. So you can really get a lot out of a seed packet. And seed starting is one of the combos that I most love having with flower friends. I think the reason I love it so much is that I notice everyone does things a little bit differently. They have like very particular setups and things that they like doing for their seed starting. So I love hearing new ideas or tips from others. Even if it's different from how I do it, it just helps me think through kind of what the plants are wanting and different ways that I could try to set that up or test things within that. So I'm really thinking about this as a conversation among flower friends today, this episode, and just sharing what I do here. In the past several years, as I've been learning more about flowers and how to grow them, I've learned not only from books and videos and podcasts that are coming from great authors and great experts, but I actually feel like I've learned just as much, if not more, from simply observing the plants themselves and noticing little differences day by day, and then playing around with variables like the height of the lights above the seedlings, the amount of water I give to them, things like that. When I first started, I thought there was an exact formula or recipe that I needed to follow. I just wanted to completely copy somebody else and just copy paste what they were doing into my house so I would get my seedlings to look just like theirs. But what I've learned over time that everyone's approach is really different and their setup is different, and there's a lot of reasons for that, but it really comes down to that the conditions in the area that we're starting seeds are different, and that's why it's annoying but true that you kind of have to figure out what works for you. So just as an example, the heating or the cooling system inside your house can have a really drastic effect on the seeds you start inside. Here in Seattle, I live in an older house. I think it was built in the early 1900s, and it has some really old original windows. So I often joke to my husband that we're closer to the outside conditions this way. It's very cold near these windows, but I think it's actually true. At least in talking to my friends, it seems in our home, we have more natural humidity in our house, and I don't need to spray or water plants inside as much as other people who might have a more technologically advanced heating system. Here in my house, it's taking my soil a bit longer to dry out than others. And then even within our house, there's different microclimates. I have four of those little temperature and humidity meters, and I find it really interesting to move them around the house and see what I'm noticing. In the winter, we keep our heat on 68 degrees Fahrenheit or 20 degrees Celsius during the day. And I've noticed that while our living room and kitchen are usually clocking in right at that 68 degree mark, my husband's office, where I keep the seed starting setup, is pretty consistently 3 degrees cooler at 65 degrees Fahrenheit, or in Celsius, that's 18 degrees. It makes sense that his office is colder because it's in the back of the house. And I kind of intuitively knew it was a little bit cooler back there. Sometimes I'll walk in and be like, ooh, it's a different temperature back here. But I think without the thermometers, I'm not sure I really would have thought about it as consciously. And then even within a room, there can be pretty significant differences. So we have one of those pop-out windows in our kitchen, which would actually be a great mini greenhouse. I think that's what it's intended for. But they installed it on the north side of our house and doesn't get any sunlight. It's just all shade. And so if it was on the south side of our house, it would be a great little greenhouse. But I've noticed that the temperature in that pop-out is pretty different. So when I put the thermometer there, it's closer to 63 degrees Fahrenheit or 17 degrees Celsius. And it's thinner glass, it has a metal frame bottom, so that makes sense. All of this is definitely making me think we should probably get some new windows, but what I'm trying to say about seed starting is that all of these little differences really affect the climate of where you start your seeds, and it might be good to experiment a little bit. For example, you could start a few small containers with the same seed if you sow them on the same day, and you have similar soil and moisture, and then place them in different parts of your house with some portable lights and kind of see what you notice. I think it's fun to be a scientist at home and try different variables if you can. Here at our house, I previously kept the seed starting stand in our dining room, which isn't really a dining room. It's more like a walkway to the kitchen, but I call it the dining room. The pro of this is that it's really easy to see the stand, and I would check in on the seedlings every time that I walked through to the kitchen. But the only wall the seed starting stand would fit along is right next to the main heat source in our house, and it would blow out hot air right under the right corner of the seed stand. there's also a lot of natural light streaming into that window. And because of these two things, the temperature on the seed stand was really variable throughout the day, where it would get blasts of hot air from the heat system and then direct hot sunlight through glass in the afternoon. I personally prefer a more consistent temperature for seed starting if I can get it, and I actually like a slightly cooler temperature. I kind of wanted to move the seed stand out of the main area of our house anyway, so we moved it away from the heat vent in the window in our dining room into my husband's office that doesn't, it's on the north side, so it doesn't get sunlight streaming in, and the temperatures and conditions are really consistent throughout the day. The downside of having it in his office is his door is closed while he's on calls and I can't visit with my little seedlings as much, but at a minimum, I usually start and end the day with a little visit in there and, you know, I try to pop in at lunch or other times. So my biggest takeaway, I would say, from the past few years is to just pay attention to little details and think about what's going on in the environment that you've got the seedlings in. I personally think once you have the basics of seed starting down, the most important info you need is usually not from other people or from books, but is from the plants themselves. I definitely recommend playing around with your setup and trying some variables to see what's working for you and your seedlings. And if some die along the way, I just think that that's normal and it's not a big deal. And I think the data and the info you're collecting can help instruct your next move. So I'd like to start with talking about indoor sowing, and I'll cover timing first. Here at Grow Girl Seattle, I grow seeds inside in the winter and early spring months, typically from early January to late April. Our last frost date, which I'm putting last frost date in heavy quotations, because it's listed in the Seattle area anywhere from March 21st in the Old Farmer's Almanac to April 6th on Dave's Garden website. And I've seen even dates as early as March 15th and then later in April as well. So I kind of just take the middle and I use April 1st if I'm trying to calculate off of a frost date. But I find that the weather is much more reliable towards the end of April. And I've learned the hard way not to get worm-loving plants like zinnias and basil outside before then. So if you're looking at your frost dates, you might notice some variable dates as well. And I would just say to kind of take the middle, but know that it's not going to be consistently warm out until a bit after that date. And one thing I'll note is even if your seed packet is telling you to sow 6 or 8 weeks before your last frost date, most of us don't actually need to sow everything that early. I personally find that plants are much happier when they don't dry out or get too big or root bound in their cell or their pot. So I try not to start things too early. If you start seeds too early, you'll need to bump them up into a bigger cell or pot. And that takes a lot of work to do. It takes time and energy. And when you're moving it to a bigger cell or a bigger pot, that is going to take up more room under the grow lights. So to minimize my work and be the most efficient with my limited space, and to not have to bump everything up to bigger sizes, I try to plan my seed starting around when those plants are realistically going to be happy and healthy outside, and when I'm going to realistically have room in my beds. So for example, I have a huge amount of open beds after the tulips are going to bloom this year. So instead of sowing everything that I could technically have go outside in time to be ready for that April 1st last frost date, I decided to sow warmer loving plants based on when we'd have more reliable temperatures outside and when I'd actually have room for them, which for me is going to be closer to May 1st. So getting into when I actually sowed my seeds so far this year. This year, I started my first seeds inside in January, and that was for one type only, which is Lysianthus, because they take an incredibly long time to grow. Then in early February, I started many of my cold hardy seeds, like snapdragons, poppies, pansies, scabiosa, bells of Ireland, and foxgloves. Just like the name implies, cold hardy plants, which are also called cool flowers or hardy annuals, they can handle colder temperatures, and some even benefit and thrive in those cold temperatures. They need that cool period to kind of do their thing. Besides the fact that they can really magically handle the cold, for me, they're really nice to grow logistically because I can move those outside when they're big enough and save space. I don't have to wait for the last frost date. Like I mentioned, seed starting space is limited in my house, so it's nice to grow these cold hardy seedlings first and then boot them outside while it's still somewhat cold. I started mine on February 6th this year, and then I started hardening off most of them in the past week or two, which is just about a month later. I like to plan for about 10 days of hardening off because I sometimes forget to put them out, or there will be a super rainy or cold day that I'll want to skip hardening off. And I'll talk more about hardening off later in the episode, but for most of these cold hardy or semi-cold hardy varieties, I plan on having about 40 to 45 days where they're going to need some space inside. At first, for about a month or so, it'll be fully inside, like full time. And then starting after about day 30 or so, depending on the variety, they'll spend part of the day outside and then part of the day inside during their hardening off period. And I don't like to start the next round of seeds until these cold hardy little babies are fully moved outside, because otherwise I just have a ton of trays all over my house and not enough lights to put them under. Once I get the hardy annuals outside, my seed starting area is freed up to start more tender seeds like zinnias, cosmos, basil, cilantro, and tomatoes that need warmer temperatures. I usually start those in late March, so right about now, and then again start hardening those off after about a month inside. So if I start them in late March, I'll start hardening most of them off in late April, depending on their size and the variety, and I'll get them planted out towards the beginning of May. Zinnias tend to get huge and they take up a lot of space, so for me at least, it's important not to start these too early. Last year, I trialed a super early sowing of zinnias, hoping I'd get some early blooms off them, but it didn't work well because I had to bump them up into 3-inch pots really quickly and then hold them inside during the super cold spring we had last year. The year before, I did the same thing with dahlias. I started dahlia seeds inside too early, and I had to bump them up to small pots. And in both years, I ran out of space under the lights because I was trying to put all these 3-inch pots under the lights, and they need a really high up light, and they just dry out at a different pace. It's hard to keep track of everything that way. And I was trying to rotate my trays and pots throughout the day to make sure everyone had enough time under the lights. It was just too hectic, and I didn't feel like I was getting them the proper nutritions or conditions for their size. And then I ran out of room for everything else that I wanted to start sowing, so it really threw off my timing for later plant successions. But the zinnia plants I started later, and I got them outside at the right size and time, they did a lot better once they were in the beds. They were just much healthier throughout the season than the ones that I had started way too early inside and kind of deprived of certain nutrients inside. So you can see with starting seeds inside, my goal is for this to be a super temporary stage for most varieties. I've learned over time and through a lot of trial and error that it's easier for me to start like with like. So sowing cold hardy annual or cold hardy plants first, moving them out, and then switching to more tender annuals and waiting to start those till closer to the warmth so that nothing is spending more than about a month or so full time inside my house. I don't want things dragging on forever, and I've found the longer the plants are babied in warm, cozy conditions inside, and the bigger that they're getting inside, the worse they do outside because they become really reliant on those conditions, and they have a harder time transitioning out. So like I mentioned, I think it's harder to give plants what they need inside when they're bigger because I just don't have enough space and grow lights for them. And I think they really need nutrients from the soil and the sun and the air outside. And I want them to mix in with worms and bugs and other things in the natural world that I can't give them inside. In my climate, I can pretty reliably start tender annuals outside in May and beyond by direct seeding or sowing into cells outside. So I usually turn off the grow lights at the beginning of May and don't have them on again until January of the next year. And that also like helps free up my husband's office, which he's very happy about when the grow lights turn off and he can just kind of have his office back. So next on to setup. When I first started growing seeds inside, I got a few of those Ferry Morse grow lights. Those are perfectly sized to fit over seed trays, and I just put them on card tables inside our living room. That was a great beginner setup, but looking back with a few more years under my belt, it wasn't ideal. I was using only one light stand per tray, which was down the middle of the tray, because these lights are pretty expensive, so I could only afford one per seed tray. And when I'm looking back at old photos, I can see some of the seedlings on the edge of the tray were really leggy because they were reaching for that light in the middle. Ideally, you'd put two of these stands over one seed tray since the light doesn't evenly get to the edges of the tray with just one. But again, they're pretty expensive, so that's a really pricey setup. These lights also weren't adjustable, so they were just set at one consistent height over the seedlings, and that's another thing that I've learned over time doesn't work for me. I need an adjustable height to my lights so I can get them nice and close before the seeds germinate, and then move the lights up with the seedlings as they grow. I decided to invest in a 3-tier grow light stand, and it holds 6 trays at a time. It has really bright lights that I can adjust the height on. I got mine from Gardener Supply Company, and it was pretty pricey, but at the time I was working a full-time, really demanding job, and I just didn't have the capacity to figure out how to home make a stand by myself, so it was just easier for me to pay for something. I would love more seed starting space, but we have a really small house, so my solution has been to start several rounds inside and lots of seeds outside. I'll talk about outdoor sowing later in the episode, but I just wanted to mention here that starting seeds outside has taken some pressure off my indoor setup. And then also, if my indoor tiered stand runs out of room inside and I need to make some temporary overflow space, I still have those Ferry Morse lights and the card table system that I can use as a backup. I want to mention that there's some really amazing videos and tutorials for building your grow light stand using those like chrome kind of garage style shelving units. And if I was to do it again, I'd probably just take the time and go that route, building my own, because it's definitely more cost effective and you can customize it to your needs. Before I start any seeds, I clean off my stand, which usually gets pretty dusty, and during the off season of seed starting, I'm usually storing some floral supply stuff like vases and other things on it. So I just like to wipe it down, get it cleaned off to start the year fresh, and then I get out my heat mats. I use the Vivo Sun waterproof ones that are sized for the 10-20 seed trays. It's just really nice because they fit perfectly. I also put out my seed timer power strip. And I wanted to mention this because the first power strip that I bought, it was digital and it was pretty difficult for me to program. Like, I think I'm somewhat technologically savvy, not totally, but I just could never get it right on the settings on that. So I ended up just buying a different one, and it has a round visual timer, which is just a lot easier for me to use. So I just crank it to show the current time on the timer. So say it's like 10 a.m. right now, I would just turn it to show 10 a.m. on where the arrow is pointing. And then I would just press the little buttons down around the circle for the times that I want the lights to be on or off. The power strip I use is the BN-Link 8 outlet surge protector with mechanical timer. And it has 4 outlets that are always on and 4 that are set to the timer. So I plug my heat mats into the side that's always on and then plug the lights into the side that's timed so that the lights will come on at 6 a.m. and shut off at 10 p.m. and that gives them 16 hours of light. Before I sow any seeds, I always make sure I have the yellow sticky fly traps for fungus gnats on hand or coming on their way in the mail. I put several of these fly traps around the edge of the stand, so not onto the seed trays themselves, because I find the yellow sticky fly traps to be so sticky that you don't want the little petals of the seedlings, when they get bigger, to like get stuck onto them. So I just recommend taping those, if you're going to use them, the fly traps around the edges of wherever you're starting seeds, and that way you're not going to have the seedlings sticking to them. And I put these sticky fly traps up before I see any fungus gnats. The reason for that is once you can see the gnats, they're already reproducing. So if you wait until you see them in order to put the traps up, they've already laid some eggs and had some babies. So if you can get the first generation of gnats stuck onto these traps, it really halts the whole generation and reduces future problems. So yeah, I get these traps set up before I notice any gnats so that the first ones that are born fly right onto the sticky yellow paper. They think it's a flower and then they can't reproduce because they're stuck to this paper. In the outdoor environment, there are so many other bugs and birds that can take care of this for you, but inside, fungus gnats are pretty normal because there's not predators and they can get out of control really fast if you just leave them. And they can also eat at the roots of your seedlings, so that's why I try to use like an organic, non-toxic, non-chemical solution. And I use the sticky traps that are from Greenkeeper, which are two-sided, and I find them to be extra sticky. And I just want to mention that I'm sharing brands that I'm using in this episode because not to promote them, but just because I always get asked. And when I try to keep it super general for the podcast and just describe something, I find people are always messaging me to find out the brands that I'm using. So I'm just naming the brands, and this is not sponsored or anything. I'm just trying to share what I use for ease of your listening pleasure. For seed trays, I started by using some of those standard black plastic seed trays and cells, and I've reused them every year. I really try to avoid single-use plastics here, so any plastic I bring in, I try to reuse. I've used the same ones for 4 years now, which a lot of people just take those little seed cell inserts and they just buy new ones every year. They're actually not hard to reuse, and I find if you just stack them and store them, yeah, they can be reused really well. They definitely get little small tears. They're not as hardy as some of the other brands you can buy, but they still work great. So if you've invested in those in the past, try reusing them. This past fall, I started adding Bootstrap Farmer seed trays and cells, and those are extra strength. They're BPA-free plastic, and they're designed to last much longer than those flimsy black plastic, like super thin seed cells and trays. And from Bootstrap Farmer, I got the really fun colors, which I've been loving using. And these can even go into the dishwasher if you want to clean them. But ever since I started watching Charles Dowding's videos and he gave me permission to not clean my seed cells, I do not clean them. So once I'm done with my seed starting cells for the year, I let them dry out, I stack them, and I just store them in my shed. And when I'm ready for them the next year, I just pull them out. They've got a little like dusty soil lacing them, and I just plant right into that. Some people soak, clean, and sterilize, and I used to do that in my house, but I don't do it anymore. I think what Charles Dowding says goes in my house, and I've never had an issue or a problem with doing that. So if that saves you any time at all, try it out. See if it works for you. I use the standard 10-20 size seed starting trays, and I use 72 cell plugs within that tray. You can definitely use 128 cell size for seeds like Icelandic poppies and others. Some don't even need to be bumped up before they're ready to be planted out in the garden. But for me, I like using one standard size. And for that size to have enough room that I don't need to bump them up into a bigger cell size. So the 72s are best for me here. And that way I only have one size and they're easier to stack and store. I get the 6-cell plug trays, so 12 of those 6-cell little units fit into one 10-20 size tray and make 72 cells. For soil, I currently use the Black Gold seedling mix, which can be found at most stores. It's OMRI certified. OMRI stands for Organic Material Review Institute, so it's just an organic certification. But I will note that organic does not mean sustainable. And so this seedling mix contains peat, and I'm trying to reduce my peat usage. So this year, I'm incorporating a couple different peat-free materials that I'll report back on in the future. We'll do a separate episode for that. I am still trialing them, and I don't want to recommend anything that I'm not like super loving. So I find that wetting the seedling soil in a big bowl and mixing it around with my hands, just like if I'm baking like or making pizza dough or something, I think that's really nice to do before I put the mix into the seed cells for a few reasons. When seedling soil is dry, it's really airy and it looks like the cell is full until you add water. And then when you add water, it tends to shrink down to be only partially full. So if I pre-mix with water before I put it into the cells, I find I can get a better handle on how full the cells will be when I get that seed starting mix damp and push it into the cells. Mixing in water also helps me get an even moisture throughout the tray, like all of the soil in that cell gets evenly moistened. However, if I don't feel like doing all of that pre-mixing, I often just put dry soil into cell trays. I tamp it down with my fingers, so I just take my fingers 2x2 and push it really well down. And then I'll just add more soil to fill it all the way to the top. And then I put water into the bottom tray and wait until the soil moistens before putting seeds in. Some people use a thin layer of vermiculite on top of their seed starting soil, which helps to keep moisture at the surface. And aesthetically, it just kind of can look nicer than soil over time. It's kind of like a light seed starting mulch, I would say. I used to use vermiculite, but when it's dry, it reminds me of styrofoam, how it kind of like static clings to everything. And I don't like how it gets everywhere in my house. And I just don't really find it necessary. It's just kind of costly when you're using it on a lot of cells. And yeah, I just don't need it. But it seems to work well for a lot of people. And I used to use it. So I wanted to mention that here. I personally don't soil block. I know a lot of people love it. It's great for plants, it's great for their roots, and it reduces waste that comes with plastic use. But I invested in trays up front, and I didn't want to switch to buy all new equipment. And since I reuse my trays and cells every year, I don't feel guilty about it, and the tray system is working super well for me. But I'm amazed by the soil blocking videos that I see online, and I think it's awesome, and I would love to try it in the future. I just haven't gotten there yet. For many of the seeds that I sow, they need to be on the surface of the soil and have light to germinate, so I fill the trays with soil first and place the seed on top for most varieties. Other seeds need to be covered with soil, so in that case, I would do the thing I was talking about before, where I fill the cells up with soil, tamp it down by pressing 2x2 with my fingers, then I would put the seeds in and then cover with more soil. When I sow seeds, I sometimes will sow more than one seed per cell. I do this because I'm so low on space that I just don't want to grow a tray that's not full of seedlings. No seed mix is going to have 100% germination, but the older the seeds are, the germination rate is typically going to decline. For brand new seeds, I'll sow most cells with one seed each, and then I'll just add a few extras into some cells. That way, if a few cells don't germinate, I can prick out the cells with two seedlings and fill the tray up so that every cell has something happening. Seeds don't mind being super close when they're babies, but they do get harder to prick out as they get older. So I would say, for me at least, the downside of doing extra sowing is that you have to be fairly quick to prick them out so that it doesn't disadvantage both of the seedlings in that cell. If I'm using older seeds, I'll usually do two seeds in each cell and hope for a 50% germination, and then I'll later move seedlings where they need to be to get one seedling per cell. And sometimes this just naturally happens because with things like Iceland poppies and snapdragons, the seeds are so small that I sometimes can't see that I've put a couple in one cell. And if I end up getting better germination than I'm expecting, or I have more than one seed per cell, I can either move some of the extras to a new tray. Perhaps there was like another type of seedling that didn't fully germinate, and so I can make a new six pack and fit it into a different tray. Or I can just, you know, say goodbye and pull a few out. If I have to kill off some seedlings, I always let the stronger one survive. So if there's two seedlings in a cell and one sprouted first and it's bigger and it's just about to hog all of the light that is going to hit that cell, I'll just remove the smaller one and let the big guy kind of go on and thrive. If any seedlings are really far behind the others, I find they usually get shaded out anyway, so I just usually pull those out. And you can start it in a new seed cell if you have that available and if you have room for it. For most seeds, I get them sown with some bottom water below to get the soil fully and evenly moistened. I'll put a lid on the tray and put it on the heat mat under lights. But I actually have some notes on heat mats and on lids, and it might be a hot take, but in most cases, I really don't think that heat mats or lids are necessary. The heat mat is getting germination kicked off much quicker than if it weren't there. But if you think about it, most seeds germinate outside in the spring when temps are below what they'd be in your house. So if you're sowing inside, to me, it really doesn't seem like a heat mat is necessary, unless you're maybe sowing in your basement where it's really cold. Heat mats might quicken germination, but I'm actually a little bit wary of them, especially for beginners, because in my experience, you have to really watch for signs of germination really closely and then turn off the heat mat right away when you see even one seedling germinate. Otherwise, I find my seedlings get really leggy if I leave the heat mat on too long. You might notice that even when something has proper light, some seeds kind of jump out of their cell and you can see the white part of the stem or even the root. And that part is supposed to be under the soil. And for me, seedlings tend to get more jumpy when they're too warm. I have four heat mats, but I have room for six trays on my seed starting stand. So I usually only start four of the six trays off with heat. Again, the only difference I've noticed is that the ones with heat get germination started a bit quicker. But for the trays I start with heat, again, I'm watching them super closely and I turn off the heat when I see anything green, even if it's only one cell. Because I start seeds with limited space and I don't need a whole tray of 72 cells of most of the flower varieties I'm starting, I often have multiple types of seeds in one tray. For example, let's say 36 snapdragons and 36 poppies. If I see any germination on either side, I turn off the heat immediately. I don't love heat, I use it sparingly, and if I can't watch the seeds closely throughout the day, I will just give the trays one day of a heat mat to give them a boost on germinating, and then I'll turn the heat mat off completely. I'm also not a huge fan of lids, because to me, that level of constant moisture isn't replicating outdoor conditions. I don't really understand it. But I do use lids temporarily for one reason. Keeping the moisture in for about 24 hours helps me to get even moisture in the soil throughout the cell tray. And I've noticed, like, if I use a heat mat and a lid, do you ever notice that the water is evaporating and it forms little droplets on the lid? That moisture is getting at the seeds and at the soil from the top and the bottom, and it helps ensure the seed is getting wet. So I personally use lids briefly, but just to get the soil wet the whole way through the tray and to get the seed wet, and then I take the lids off. And I personally never keep lids on past germination. It just seems like a breeding ground for fungal problems to me. I don't understand this. If someone understands it more, like why people are so excited into lids, like please let me know. But I just haven't found that it makes a huge difference for me other than like getting that consistent moisture in the soil at first. And again, this might depend on the conditions in your house or your seed starting area, because my house doesn't tend to dry out soil as quickly, so I've found not using a lid or using one only sparingly works for me, but it might be different in your home, and it's just something to try and see what you prefer. As far as grow lights, I like to get the grow lights pretty close to the seedlings. I experimented a lot with that setup, and it really depends on the strength of your light, but for me, I found bringing the light closer to my seedlings drastically improve their grow rate. I keep the light probably about 3 to 4 inches away from the soil surface, and then as the seeds germinate and grow, I move the lights up with the seedlings, keeping the light consistently about 3 to 4 inches above the top of my tallest seedlings. Now, I don't want you to try that and burn your little seedlings if you've been keeping them like 6 or 8 inches above your seedlings. Your light might be stronger than mine, so I'm not saying to just like adjust to use that, but if you're finding that you're having trouble with the rate that your seedlings are growing, they might not be getting enough light, and you could test out bringing it a little bit closer. Maybe just do it on one tray to start so you don't burn a bunch of things, but just experiment with the level of the light and see if that helps with your growth weight. See if that helps with your growth rates. I also have 2 fans attached to my grow light stand. These are ones that I got from VivoSun, and they're just little clip-on fans. They have like a square clip-on, so they fit right on the edge of the stand. And it would probably be best to have 3 of those, so each tier of the stand had a fan. But I actually move the seed trays around quite a bit, and in theory I could move the fans too. Fans help to imitate the wind, which helps the seedling stalks get stronger and not flail over in the wind later, like the first time you put them outside. So the fans, I find, are also improving overall airflow in the room. And then as an added bonus, I've noticed that fungus gnats don't like the fans, and they'll go cling to the sticky traps much more when the fans are on. As far as moving trays around, I like to think of it just like you might rotate a pizza or something that you're baking in the oven. I actually like to rotate my seed trays. And granted, I probably have a lot more time to think about things like this than a big farmer who's doing a whole greenhouse full of seed trays, but I just have the one little stand with 6 trays at a time, so it's fun to play around with stuff like this. The grow lights that I use seem really consistent, and they have a hood over them that reflects light really evenly onto the seedlings. But sometimes if I don't rotate the trays, I notice the seedlings on the far end of the stand are shorter, while the seedlings in the middle look great. And I think that's just because the ones on the edge aren't getting the same amount of light. So I've learned to rotate my trays every couple days or so, just like a 180-degree turn of the tray to switch which seed cells are on the outside and inside, which are closest to the fan, and to give everybody a fair shot at the light. Another thing I've learned is to not overwater my seedlings. If you have a lot of green algae, that's pretty normal for a super moist environment with light, but you can help combat that by reducing water and not let seedlings sit in standing water constantly. When I first started, I would bottom water all of my seedlings quite a bit, so there was always excess water at the bottom of the trays. And now I only bottom water until the seedlings are large enough that I can apply water right to the top of the cells, which is what they'll be more used to in the garden, is like having water on that part of their soil and sinking down into the soil. So I think it's just imitating the outdoors better. And when the seedlings are super small, you know, you don't want to top water them because they're so little and frail that they can fall over. But when they get big enough, I think that's a good way to do it. And then when I bottom water, I'm usually only filling the trays up maybe like an eighth or a sixth of the way, just so the soil can fully soak up the water quickly and there's not standing water left after an hour or two. So you can play around with amounts and see how quickly your soil takes to soak up the water. I also let the soil dry out a bit after watering. I like to pull a little 6-cell plug tray out and just look at the bottom soil at the very bottom of the cells and kind of gauge their water content. It's actually really nice and easy to do it on the Bootstrap Farmer cell trays because they're open. They have like an open circle at the bottom of each cell. So it makes it really easy to pull out a little 6-cell plug tray, look at the soil on the bottom and look at the moisture content there or how dry or how damp that water is or that soil is. And that little open circle at the bottom also makes it really easy to push the plugs out when they're ready to plant. The Bootstrap cells also have air channel slits up the side of each cell, so I can also see the roots and kind of look at the moisture throughout the whole inch or two of that cell. I find these cells really handy for monitoring soil moisture, and I just pull one out and look at the bottom. If I see some moisture in the soil, I usually wait to water a little bit longer. The top layer of soil in these seed trays is often deceiving because it's sitting right under the grow lights, so I like looking at the bottom to see what's really going on. And basically, I don't want seedling roots sitting in standing water. I want them to get used to searching a little bit for water, not get like soaked or waterlogged or rot in standing water. Next, most seed starting mixes don't have many, if any, nutrients in them. So after seedlings germinate and get growing, I find it helpful to give them a boost with some diluted liquid fertilizer. Last year in my house, I just had some Espoma organic indoor plant liquid fertilizer. It was handy. I was using it for my indoor plants to help give them a little bit of nutrients, and I knew it didn't smell bad. So I just tried that instead of using fish fertilizer or kelp fertilizer. Those are the ones that I use outside in my garden, but I didn't want to bring them in because I don't want my whole house to smell. And the Espoma indoor plant fertilizer worked great. I just used a little quarter cap full in about 4 cups of water, so it was really diluted. This year, I've actually switched and I'm using Fox Farm organic liquid fertilizer. It's the Big Bloom one, and I'm just diluting it at the rate suggested for seedlings on the back. I've used the Fox Farm organic for outside plants in the past, and it's great, but it's really pricey. But I found for seedlings, because it's so diluted, it's definitely more cost effective. So now let's talk about hardening off. For most of the seeds I sow, it's a little different for everything, but I'd say about a month completely inside is pretty average for me. I like to get seedlings to a big enough size where they're bulky and they can handle the outdoors, but like I mentioned, not have them inside for too long. Once they get to that right size, I start hardening them off. It's hard to explain the exact size that I'm looking for because every seedling has a different shape and growth habit. But in general, I'm looking for at least a few leaf sets and some healthy root growth. If there's so many roots that they've started twisting around the edge of the soil inside the cell and wrapping the seedling in roots, that's called root bound, and it's usually too long in the cell to thrive once it gets outside. So I'm looking for enough healthy roots that I can see the plant is doing well, it's getting strong roots, but I'm not waiting until all that I can see is roots. When I'm pushing them out, there's some roots started along the outside. It kind of can hold its shape when I'm pushing the soil out, but it's not completely root bound. In case you haven't hard enough seedlings before, it just means that you're taking the seedlings you've grown inside and you're slowly acclimating them to the outdoor world. You're basically taking them from this kind of perfectly climate controlled inside and you're putting them in a really highly variable climate outside, and they need time to get used to it. So just for example, they're used to a grow light and they're going to need some time adjusting to the real sunlight. And they're also used to like my indoor temperature, humidity, the indoor water that I'm using, the fan that's blowing on them with like really consistent timing. It's like boom, boom. And it just keeps that pace all day. So now I'm getting them ready for the big real world, like for the sun, the wind, the rain. I'm putting them outside for short stints and then gradually increasing the length that I leave them outside. I mentioned before that I like to plan on 10 days for hardening off. And that's not because I'm actually spending a full 10 days doing this, but moving trays inside and outside, it takes some effort and some time. And sometimes I'll start hardening them all off on a perfect sunny day. And then the next day it'll be freezing, it'll be pouring rain. So I'm not going to put these little baby cells outside in those conditions when they just haven't had a chance to acclimate yet. Or sometimes I forget to put the seedlings out before I leave to do other errands and I just miss a day of hardening off. So now I like to plan to leave enough time to harden off the best that I can without assuming that the seedlings will have perfect conditions for the full period. I try to get them outside for 5 or 6 times before I move them outside full time. I have a covered porch and that helps protect the wind and the rain, and it has less intense sunlight, so that's where I start hardening my seedlings off. We have wooden slats along the railing of our porch, so as the sun moves, the shadows on each of these slats move. And I like that because the seedlings each get little breaks from the sun as the shadows move along the slats. On the first day of hardening off, I usually put the trays out for about an hour. I like them to be in a sheltered spot where they get a little bit of wind and mostly shade, and if I can get it, a small amount of sunlight, just to introduce them and say, hey, this is the sun. You've only met artificial lights. Let's introduce you to the sun, but not burn you from the sun. The next day, I try to get them out with some sun, which for me is hitting the porch in the afternoon. So I'll put them out for maybe a few hours, like 3 or 4 hours. Like I mentioned, I like the porch slats for this, which as the sun moves, they're rotating which seedlings have sunlight on them, so that no individual seedling is getting a full 3 hours of sun. They get little breaks from when the shadows from the slats move or when a cloud is in front of the sun. Then I'll put them out for maybe 6-ish hours the next time, get some more sunlight. I'll put them lower down on the steps on my porch or on my driveway. Both of those areas aren't covered, but they get short periods of shade when the sun moves. So for example, if the sun's behind a tree and then there's a telephone pole near our driveway, so certain parts of that get shade at points during that 6-hour period. Then the next time I'll leave them out for almost a full day. And then the next time, maybe I'll wait until after dinner to bring them in so they get to feel the temperature dropping, so leave them out till like 10 p.m. Basically, you're just gradually getting them more time outside in the best way you can. There's no perfect way to do this, but I'm just trying to introduce them to the sun and the wind and the rain, and then also to fluctuations in temperature and light and moisture. After I harden them off, I get them in the ground. For cold hardy seedlings like the ones I'm ready to plant now, most should be fine going outside before the first frost if they're hardened off. However, even cold hardy seedlings can experience shock if they haven't been hardened off. So just because something says it's cold hardy, it doesn't mean you can take it from its warm, cozy, perfect conditions that it's had like its whole babyhood and put it outside and that it'll just be fine. Most seedlings need a transition time. And seedlings are always just more vulnerable. They're less stable than adult plants. So even if the adult version of the seedling can withstand cold winters outside, the seedlings are going to be more fragile. And for me, like I mentioned, even though I can technically plant out most tender, warm-loving seedlings outside after that official last frost date, whatever that date is, I actually now wait to do that until the temperatures are more consistent. One thing that's fun to do is to take a little kitchen thermometer like you would use for a chicken and stick it into the soil. The soil is often warmer than the air and it can retain heat in a different way than air does. So if you have the time, go ahead and just record some air temps and some soil temps during the week or so that you're hardening plants off and getting them in the ground, and save those records for next year. See how the plants do throughout this season and go back and record that and just see if you notice any trends, like if you got them out too cold and they had a shock, or the soil temperature was consistently above XX temperature and that worked really well. So it's just fun to notice trends and just kind of keep that for your record so you can think more about your timing for next year. Okay, I think that covers everything I can think of as far as what I do for indoor sowing on through when those little babies are getting ready to plant out. And now I want to switch over to outdoor sowing, which is something I've been trying to do more of, to mimic how the seeds would start in the wild, and then also to reduce the amount of space and resources that I'm using on starting plants inside. If you think about a plant's life cycle, many plants form seed heads in the summer and fall, and then they drop their seeds, or those seeds might get eaten by animals and carried nearby. But once they're on the ground, those seeds might germinate and start growing right away in the summer or fall, and the seedling gets bulky enough to get through the winter and blooms in the spring or the summer. Or the seeds might need a cold period to germinate. If you think about like seed packets you might get for delphinium or larkspur or Leia, things like that, that say to put the packet in the fridge for a few weeks before you germinate, they're trying to mimic that cold period the seeds need to kind of like crack on with getting open and germinating. So if left outdoors, those seeds would drop from the plant once they've dried out in the summer or fall, spend the winter as seeds in the cold, and germinate when temperatures warm up in the late winter or early spring, and then again bloom in the spring or summer. For me, that life cycle is so awesome to think about on a few levels, because if I try to mimic nature and do some of my seed sowing outside, it hopefully will make healthy plants that are following this natural cycle, and also will free up some space for me inside, because it's meaning less that I need to sow in the spring and less to sow inside. Other plants that are more like tender or warm-loving plants, they can't overwinter here in Seattle. But if you want to start them outside without any indoor time, they can be direct sown in the late spring and early summer. The real reason we're starting things inside is to get an earlier start on flowering and to fit more successions and more flowers into the bloom season. But if you don't have an indoor seed starting setup, or if you want to do more successions outside, I think it's fantastic to play around with doing that. And if you live in a different climate than me, somewhere warmer or colder, just experiment with what works for you. Kind of look at what plants you see in your neighbor's yard or in the wild when you're taking a walk, what the plants are doing, which ones are kind of self-seeding on your property, and just observe what they do and what timeline they're growing on. I find that self-seeded plants are often stronger and healthier than the seedlings that I'm starting indoors, because it's truly survival of the fittest outside, and the strong seeds that are landing in the right conditions take hold. So I try to notice that, what those conditions are, and think through that and see if it tells me anything. For example, I had some Scabiosa stellata that I was growing for dried pods last year, and the plants got really huge and wild, and I just didn't get around to cutting all of the stems before the fall rains came. So the wind and the rain in the fall was kind of blowing the seeds off of the seed heads. They're like little circles on like a round seed head, and so they kind of blow easily in the wind. They're kind of like little mini parachutes or something. And they ended up all over my flower pots, my garden beds, and then even between like the stones and the bricks in our walkway, which is really narrow, but somehow they took hold and germinated there. So I had hundreds of seedlings germinate from these Scabiosa stellata. And by December, I noticed that those seedlings, which I had originally thought were weeds, were actually growing up from those little stellata seeds. I could see those cups at the base of the seedlings, and I was like, wow, these are plants I actually want. I didn't cover or do anything to protect these, and they all survived through the winter as if nothing had happened through several cold snaps and snow. And again, I wasn't doing anything to protect them or treat them specially. And now they each have several leaf sets, and I'm thinning them out and removing them from where I don't want them. But I have a few pots where I'm just going to let them go wild. Every year, some of my sweet peas and foxgloves do the same thing where they drop seeds before I can go out and collect them, and the same thing is happening. So self-sowing by the plants themselves is not only a great way for me to like kind of observe and learn what they might do in a more natural, less like human intervention space, but also for me to get more plants. And you can just pull them up from where you don't want them and even move them or transplant them somewhere else. Word to the wise though, if you have self-sowers that you don't want to come back, clean those plants up before they drop their seeds, because otherwise you'll just be dealing with removing lots and lots of babies. I already knew some of this intuitively, that we could really play around with timing and mimic what would happen without our intervention. There's a lot of things I'd already been planting out in the fall, like just for example, ranunculus and anemones and other bulbs. And I'd also sown some true biennial foxgloves, like the cafe creams, that don't bloom the first year. And I just, you know, sowed those in maybe January, February, got the plants to a nice size, planted them out with all my other foxgloves. And then those, they just created bulked up like green patches the first year. And then I left those outside to overwinter. And the following year, a huge amount of blooms came from each of those little patches. And then some perennial plants that I've sown from seed too, where I've overwintered them and they've come back year after year. And I've had the book Cool Flowers by Lisa Mason Ziegler for a couple years already, and I'd read it and leafed through it many times, but I'm just one of those people who has to try something for themselves or see it for themselves to really learn it and get it fixed into my brain. So I took all this info and I wanted to try to mimic these plants and intentionally sow what I want to outside. For me, there's a couple great times to do this. One would be in the summer for cold hardy plants that can overwinter, for example, things like foxgloves. I'd probably plant those out in July or August, starting the seeds outside when they might fall off a mature plant, and get that plant big enough to survive before the cold and the rain and the darkness is settling in. I've also started some seeds outside in the winter, in December or January, to give them a cold period and get their roots growing. For example, things like sweet peas. Here in Seattle, I found that works best undercover to help prevent inundation from the rain. I don't have a greenhouse here, but I do have two small little zippies, which are just clear plastic mini greenhouses. And the ones I have are maybe like 4 feet by 2 feet. So 4 feet long, 2 feet wide, and then maybe about 2 feet tall. It's kind of shaped like a little house, so it has like an arched or a triangle-shaped roof. And so that way, like, water can drip down off it and not get sunken into the middle. So I love using those zippies, and I'm still experimenting with overwintering cold hardy seeds. So I'll talk more about that in a minute. But the next time I would sow things outside would probably be April or May, when it warms up enough here to start some warmer living seeds directly in the ground or in seed trays outside. For cold hardy plants, as I mentioned, I've done a few trials the past couple years. So in December 2021, I sowed sweet peas straight into 4-inch pots, and I kept them outside all winter, and they grew into the best sweet peas that I've ever grown. And I really need to credit Marin from Farmhouse Flower Farm, who I got to see this past weekend. It was so great. But by the way, actually, you should go back and listen to her episode of Flower Friends. We did a farm tour on her flower farm last spring. So go back and listen to that. Marin is fabulous. But prior to that farm tour, I had taken her sweet pea course online, and through that and other interviews that she's done on sweet peas, I was hearing her say how much sweet peas love cold weather to get their start, and it occurred to me that even though I don't have a greenhouse, I could start them outside and imitate people with a real greenhouse on a really small scale. So what I did was I took little plastic containers, just reusing ones that I'd bought plants in at the nursery, the little like 3 or 4 inch plastic containers, and I put some moistened soil into those containers, and I just poked a few holes with my fingers, maybe about an inch deep, in the corners of the pots, and then I took some soaked sweet pea seeds that I had just had in water for a couple hours. I dropped the seeds into those holes and I covered the holes with soil. Then I got out those clear mini plastic greenhouses that I mentioned that I love calling zippies. That's what they call them in the UK. And I took some bungee cords and secured them to a couple tables I had outside. One was to our picnic table and I attached the other one to a metal table on our deck. I was using the bungee cords just to make sure that the greenhouse wouldn't blow away, because there's not a lot to hang on to. You know, they're plastic and they're not heavy, so they can easily blow away. And I was just basically putting them onto these tables, even though the tables weren't the perfect size for these. I was just using the plastic zippies not to hold in heat or to fit perfectly on the tables, but to prevent water, or to help me control the water that was getting onto the seedlings. So I used it just like a cover or like a tent. And the reason I did this is because I find rain in the Pacific Northwest is such a killer in the winter. It's just kind of nonstop, and little seedlings that are getting pelted with rain every single day in and out, they just sometimes fizzle out and give up, especially when they're really small seedlings. And many seedlings don't do well when they're wet and then the temperature drops below freezing, because it's freezing the cells in their brand new leaves. And that might be okay for some bigger plants, like around the edges of certain leaves or some lower leaves or upper leaves. And it might be okay for certain seedlings, but most seedling varieties can't handle constant rain followed by dips in freezing temperatures when they're super small plants. So for me, the zippies were just intended to prevent any water I didn't want getting onto the sweet peas. So I just took all the little 4-inch pots of sweet peas, I lined them up on these tables in rows under the zippies. Again, it was not airtight. Air could get in around the bottom of the structure, and that was actually good for airflow without letting rain in. And then the zippies have two flaps, the ones that I have, that you can open for airflow. So I would just open them on warmer or drier days. But when it was really rainy, I'd close up the zippies and I'd keep the sweet pea seedlings dry. It took the seeds a lot longer to germinate and grow above the soil level outside than it does for me indoors. But these outdoor sown sweet peas look so much healthier than any I'd ever grown inside. They were super tough and strong, and they had lots of like deep green leaves, and there wasn't a lot of space between the leaf sets. They were just really bulky and they had strong roots. If I look at the sweet peas that I have started inside in the past, at least, you know, just here, the ones that I used to grow, I found them to be super leggy, and there was always like an inch or more between leaf sets. And then out in the garden, I would notice how when I wouldn't get around to collecting all my sweet pea seeds off the plants right away in the summer, I would see how the little seeds would fall into the soil and they would germinate on their own in the garden. And those seedlings look so much healthier than the seeds that I was starting inside. So trying to mimic that process and give them a cold germination really seemed to help. And it also saved me a lot of space to not have to start those seeds inside in January. And then it also just required a lot less fussing. I literally just left them on the picnic table all winter with very little watering needed. I paid them very little attention. And then on super warm or sunny days, if the soil looked dry, I would just add a little bit of water, or if I knew there wasn't a freeze coming. And then when they got big enough, I just pulled out these little pots and separated them into three or four plants and planted them right into the sweet pea bed. So they were outside the entire time. That same year, back in 2021, Kristen from Neighborhood Flower Co. and I, we decided to start some winter sowings of Lysianthus and poppies. So we just got plugs from Farmer Bailey's and we planted them into our flower beds in December. And the poppies basically did not notice anything. They didn't care about the rain, the snow, the cold temperatures. They just really chugged away. They were growing slowly over the winter. They were completely uncovered, at least for me here, and they made it through again like nothing had happened, and they bloomed really early and really happily. The Lysianthus, on the other hand, the plugs that we tried to start in December, they got pretty soaked and frozen and they fizzled out. And at least for me, they weren't a good fit for Pacific Northwest winter uncovered. But I really learned a lot by doing that. Now, for a little bit more on the failure side, learning all of this, I had big plans to do a bunch of summer sowing last year. I had my seed starting sheet set up to sow a bunch of things in July 2022, so they'd have enough time to bulk up and get planted once I was ready to do some fall cleanup, and they would be big enough to withstand the winters outdoors and then bloom this year in 2023. Well, with everything going on at the height of summer, just lots of blooms to harvest, events to design for, I had subscriptions I was delivering, was doing the podcast, I have another job, just trying to live my life, also have some friends and some social things outside of flowers. I just didn't get those sowed in time, and I waited until September to sow them. So some things like snapdragons, foxgloves, campanula, stock, poppies, things that I'd seen in the Cool Flowers book and elsewhere, and I wanted to try growing with their complete life outside. The seedlings did germinate and they looked great, but most of them didn't make it through the winter, and I definitely know why. First of all, I think it was too late when I sowed them, and they didn't have enough time to bulk up and get big enough by the time the rain and the cold hit. And then when the rain and cold did hit, I didn't get them covered with the zippy. I have a little bit of a see what happens attitude. Sometimes I just love like testing things and pushing things to the limit just to see what happens. Even if I know better and have had trials like the Lysianthus before where I knew little seedlings couldn't take our winters. And so these seedlings just went through downpour after downpour. They were uncovered and many of them just didn't have enough life left in them to make it through when the winter freezes came. I'm pretty sure if I had started them in July or even in August, I could have planted them out and they would have done well. Some might have needed a little bit of covering not to get drenched by the constant rain. Or if I had covered them and protected them under the mini plastic greenhouses, I think they would have survived and done a lot better. But despite all of the poor conditions, there were a bunch of larkspur and delphinium seedlings, as well as some poppies and foxgloves that did make it through, just uncovered in cell trays to handle all of the elements on their own. And then I actually started another tray with a mix of cold hardy seeds on my porch in January, and those are doing really well. So it's nice because with both of these, it took pressure off when I'm starting inside this year. And then I'm going to block off some time this summer to focus on seed starting for a strong fall planting. So for me, it's just all about trial and error. And while it might have wasted some seeds, a lot of those seeds were ones that I collected myself. And it just doesn't feel as big of a loss when you're collecting them yourself instead of paying for brand new seeds. And then the info and the knowledge that I gathered, it really feels great to have. And like I said, sometimes I just have to try things on my own, maybe even two or three times before I really get something. And so now I think I've really hammered it into my head as if learning from, you know, losing those Lysianthus wasn't enough data. I think I've really got the limits of where I live in my head, that most seedlings that are small can't make it through our dark, rainy winters without protection. So I really recommend, if you're killing seeds or seedlings, to try not to panic and just learn from it if you can, and try to laugh about it if you can. It's easier to do once time has passed. And I think if you're going to kill something, it's way better to kill a pretty inexpensive seedling than a really expensive rose or dahlia or peony. So if you're killing a bunch of seedlings and you're frustrated about it, just like give yourself a slow clap for a minute that you didn't kill a rose, you know? Just gotta go for the benefits. And then you can always start more seeds, even if it's too late for some of the varieties that you wanted, you might have killed them. You can just sow a different kind of seed. Even if it's late in the season, you can usually get something close to 60 days, like sunflowers, and some herbs that grow really quickly and they work as fragrant fillers or little delicate flowers. So I think that takes us through seed sowing, at least how I do it here. I hope that I can someday live in a place where I have a greenhouse or a hoop house, and then everything will change about how I sow seeds and when I sow them. But for now, so far, I've found my best rhythm with a few of the main themes that I talked about. First is grouping my sowing strategically, doing like, with what I'm planting inside so I can get each round hardened off and moved outside around the same time. Number two, I'm trying not to let things linger too long inside my house. And number three, I'm sowing more seeds outside, either into trays or directly in the garden, and playing around with how that works for me. And as I mentioned back in parts one and two of this little series, I've been putting more and more perennials in over time, both ones that I've sown from seeds or grown from bulbs, tubers, rhizomes, cuttings, or that I've gotten from potted plants, either from my nursery or from local flower friends. And by having more long-term plants in the garden, that's also reduced the pressure on annual seed starting, and it's filled out the bloom year a bit more because a lot of the perennials will bloom at times when the annual seeds aren't blooming as much. Like I'm particularly thinking of the late May, early June timeframe when a lot of the summer seedlings haven't started blooming yet, but there's a lot of perennials that are in their full peak at that moment. And then I just want to remind you that I would love to hear from you on the new voicemail hotline that I set up for Flower Friends. One more time, it's 7313-FLOWER or 731-335-6937. And I'll drop the number in the show notes as well. So call in and tell me the best tip you've ever received on seed sowing, or something you've learned from your plants, something you learned from your neighbor down the street, or the old man that walks by your garden every day and gives you unsolicited tips, and then you actually try some and you're like, oh, this guy's legit. He knows what he's talking about. Or maybe you learned something from your mom or your grandma or anyone in your family or friends. I would love to hear about it, and I'd love to hear what you're trying differently and what you're experimenting with this year. So again, 7313-FLOWER. Leave me a message and I might play it on an upcoming episode so I can share your hot tip with all our flower friends that are listening in. And then I wanted to provide a few more resources. So if you're just tearing through gardening content right now while you're starting your seeds and you're outside gardening or prepping your beds, I wanted to recommend some previous Flower Friends episodes. Even if you've listened to them before, I love going back and listening to old episodes because sometimes I'll log one or two tips from an episode, but it's like the wrong season that I'm logging that in my brain. And so I love going back and listening and re-listening to old episodes to kind of refresh my memory. So back on the April 18th, 2022 episode, I sat down with Margaret Ullman Hess from Ballard Urban Flowers, and we talked about seed starting. There's also a seed sourcing episode with Renee Shepherd from Renee's Garden that was posted in August last year, August 21, 2022. And Renee's garden is one place that I love buying some really unique seed varieties from. Then for garden starting, I really love the episode where I got to talk with Janice Groves from Jay's Garden Journal about sheet mulching. That was back on April 11th, 2022. Jay taught me and many others how to expand my garden space using cardboard and newspaper to kill back weeds and improve soil in a really environmentally friendly and easy to do way. Jay actually just posted some reels where she speeds this process up on video. I love watching that. And so those are great to go check out as well. And then I've been using sheet mulching again the past couple weeks because I'm redoing part of my rain garden and I'm trying to stop some bindweed and morning glories. So I went back and listened to that episode as I was doing that just for fun. And then for the first interview I ever did on the podcast, I got to speak with Hillary Dahl from Seattle Urban Farm Co. about making raised beds for the garden, and that was posted on April 4th, 2022. And last, I wanted to recommend the landscape design episode with Dorsey Kilburn from May 30th, 2022. She gave some great tips and advice for making your outdoor space really enjoyable for yourself and your family. So peek back in the Flower Friends catalog. There are some great episodes for projects you might be tackling in your garden this time of year. And there's also great episodes on floral design and other topics. And while you're at it, please take the time to rate and review the podcast. I love hearing your feedback, and rating and reviewing the show helps other people find it. You can also follow along to see photos from each episode on the Flower Friends podcast Instagram, which is just @ Flower Friends Podcast. That's it for now, and I will be back with season 4 so soon. I am like jumping up and down with excitement to share these interviews with you. Just some more amazing guests and just wonderful conversations that I feel so honored and privileged to get to talk to some of these people, learn from these people. And so, yeah, I can't wait to share those. Until then, I'm signing off from Seattle, and I am sending you so much love, my flower friends. Take care. Bye.